TED Audio Collective.
Hi, I'm Debbie Millman. Canva is great for designing visual content for work, no matter what industry or department you work in. Nail your next presentation with Canva Presentations. Start with a professionally designed template and use it as a springboard for your design. It's a serious time saver. Time to present but can't be there in person? Enter Canva Talking Presentations. Record yourself presenting and add your talking head to your slides so your audience can watch your perfected presentation anywhere, anytime. Start designing today at canva.com. Designed for work.
Apple Card is the perfect cash back rewards credit card. You can earn up to 3% daily cash on every purchase every day. That's 3% on your favorite products at Apple, 2% on all other Apple Card with Apple Pay purchases, and 1% on anything you buy with your titanium Apple Card or virtual card number. Visit apple.co/cardcalculator to see how much you can earn. Apple Card issued by Goldman Sachs Bank USA, Salt Lake City branch. Subject to credit approval. Terms apply.
This is Design Matters with Debbie Millman. On this episode, Debbie talks with Mauro Porcini, the Chief Design Officer at PepsiCo.
When you see the customer excited about your idea, let's launch it, let's do it. And it works. It works very well.
The interview took place at the ProMax conference in front of a live online audience because of the epidemic. Debbie spoke with Mauro Porcini by video.
Mauro Porcini is the first chief design officer in PepsiCo's entire 121-year history. In that role, he leads innovation by design across the company's entire food and beverage portfolio. Mauro's approach to design has earned him hundreds of personal and professional accolades. He has over 800 design awards from his work at PepsiCo alone. He was designated one of Fortune magazine's 40 Under 40, a Fast Company Master of Design, and one of the most 50 influential designers in America. He's also, my favorite, one of the 10 Italians that will change the world. And lastly, he was also named one of the 30 best-dressed men of 2015 by GQ. Mauro joins me today from his home on Long Island for a very special live episode of Design Matters at the ProMax conference, where we will talk about his childhood in Italy, his corporate design work with Philips, 3M, and Pepsi, and the creation of his brand new podcast titled In Your Shoes. Mauro, welcome to Design Matters.
Hi, Debbie. What a pleasure.
How are you? We've been wanting to do this for a long time, and I finally got you in the hot seat.
Yes.
Is it true that you were recently recognized with a knighthood by the President of the Italian Republic?
It is true. That was such an honor, obviously, but also such a pleasure because, you know, I love my country. I love the U.S. that is hosting me today in these days. And I love, you know, the United States of America. But obviously, I profoundly love also my country. And that kind of recognition for something that I'm doing outside of the country, by the way, is really such an honor and such a pleasure.
You grew up in a small town outside Milan in Italy with parents who were deeply committed to culture. I read that you had two passions growing up, the world of literature and philosophy, which was influenced by your mother, and the world of art, architecture, and drawing, which was influenced by your father. What did your parents do for a living?
Well, my father was an architect, and then he was teaching technical drawing in high school. My mother, for a reason or the other, somehow was forced by her parents to do finance that she hated, but she's been writing and reading and all her life. And she always had a little book by her bed and she would write every day. And then she was completely, absolutely not technological. She wouldn't know how to use technology. Still today, she has those old phones, you know, not tech at all. But as soon as internet was available, she created her own blog because she had this need of sharing her thoughts and her poems and her writing. And then my father was sketching and drawing. He's been doing that all his life. And so they would publish together on their blog the poems and the drawings and the paintings, and then over time, then they switch to social media, to those platforms. But it is really interesting to see this anti-technological person that had a need so profound, so deep of sharing her thinking that she overcome, you know, that roadblock, and she used a channel that she's not familiar with. I think we're seeing this happening today with COVID. So many people that never use the digital media, the digital channels, are using it for the first time, either for to communicate, to connect, to share, or to buy and purchase. It's something that is happening today, driven by those specific needs.
What is your first memory of being creative? Do you remember?
Well, you know, I think I don't remember the specific one, you know, one specific one, but for sure, I had always this need of designing something, creating something. At the beginning, imitating what my father was doing. So he would experiment with all kind of techniques. And there was something that I really, really loved because it was somehow magical. It's called pyrography. I think it's, you say it like this in English. In Italian, it's pirografia. And essentially is drawing using a pen that is made of fire. I mean, it's hot, and so it burns the surface. And both my father and my grandfather were drawing on wood. And my experiment was to use the same technique, but not just on wood, also on leather. And so I would start to draw on leather. And then at a certain point, I realized that I was doing something that people actually wanted. So I started to give it to my friends. And then after a while, I realized that I could even sell it. And that was
the entrepreneur.
Yes, exactly. That's really one of my very first memory of connecting my love for drawing and creating with some form of business sense.
I love that they were created sort of at the same time. It makes a lot of sense. Initially,
actually,
you wanted to pursue...
Debbie, actually,
please go ahead.
I just realized something that, you know, while I was talking with you, that so I was somehow inspired by my parents on that creativity, right? Both in the world of art and in the world of writing and philosophy. But then there were things that I did that were the opposite of what my parents would do. For instance, this business sense, if you want, my parents had zero business sense, but nothing at all. And actually, even the idea of making money, for instance, or fame, of all those things were something they didn't like too much. Because they were afraid they would take people away from, you know, a stable life and good values and the right way. So when they started to, you know, to make some money and in life, I remember my mother really concerned at a certain point. Then she realized that, you know, I kept being the good son that I was before, and now she's, you know, totally in peace. But at the beginning, she was like, oh my God, you know, he's not gonna lose his way. So this aspect is interesting. You know, your parents either inspire you by, you know, you imitate what they do, or sometimes you want to do something that eventually was a gap or was different than what they did because you're trying to form your own identity. You're trying to be yourself in a way or the other. Another area that is very interesting, I think my mother is super shy. My father even more. My father doesn't.
Really?
My father just... Yeah, they're the opposite than me. And they just, you know, my father just expressed himself literally through art every day. My mother is shy with others, but I remember when I was a kid, she will always celebrate people able to be on a stage and talk to other people and share ideas and drive people with emotions, with passions, and with thoughts. And so somehow for me, that idea was a myth. I wanted to be that. You know, my mother she wanted to be that, but she was not. And so that's another area
she
where
wanted
she
wanted to do,
you know,
it for
I tried
her
to fill a gap. Yeah, somehow probably there was that component as well. And she's very proud now. Like, we'll talk.
Oh, I can only imagine. Initially, you wanted to pursue architecture. Why?
Well, because I didn't know that design existed. And I'm realizing today that many people, even today, have no clue what design is. I think all of us, for instance, I'm really happy of the fact that these new digital platforms give us the possibility as designers to share what we do with the world. The idea, for instance, of your podcast, and many, many years later, you know, I've been imitating you, and I created my own podcast as well, is also about, you know, sharing with as many people as possible. So I had no clue design existed. Actually, it didn't exist in Italy. And this is a paradox, because obviously we have many renowned designers, but the vast majority of those designers were either architects or engineers or people anyway that didn't study formally in a university design. And the first university of design was actually created, I think, 1993, in Polytechnic of Milano. Before, there was not a university level, a college level education for designers. So I decided to study architecture. And then a friend of mine was at high school with me, one day calls me and is like, oh, you know that there is this new thing, it's called disegno industriale. Already the name, they decided to translate the word design in Italian, but in Italian we use the word design. So that was a big branding mistake, because many people wouldn't understand what that means. I was thinking it was the design of industrial machines. But I was also in a situation, you know, my parents didn't have a lot of money. I really needed to work after I would get my degree. And so my passions were literature on one side and then art on the other. And literature, my parents were like, we don't know if you're gonna find an easy job in this country in that field. So architecture is a little bit more concrete. And then this disegno industriale, we're like, well, maybe it's closer to the industry, it's new, so maybe there are more opportunities. And if I don't like it, on the second year, I can switch to architecture. And then I did a test. I did very well in the test. I started, and in a few months, I realized that it was my dream. I mean, I was like, oh my God, I didn't know that they would. There is an education like this. There is a school like this. I didn't know that they're going to pay me to do this. I will do it for free. It's so fun. So right now I want to tell the world about this beautiful, beautiful profession that is design. Let's scream it to the world.
You graduated in 1994 from the Liceo Scientifico Galileo Ferraris and went on to get your master's degree from the Politecnico di Milano. You also studied at the National College of Art and Design in Dublin. At that point, did you think you wanted to be an industrial designer, or did you at that point, had you already started to consider the possibility of a multidisciplinary design career?
Well, I had no clue back then, so I didn't have that kind of awareness. But what was driving me was the idea of understanding people, their needs, their wants, their dreams, and creating solutions. Already back then, Polytechnic was very advanced. You know, you would study experience design, strategy applied to design. So already back then, we would design products, but also brands, already experiences, services, entire strategies. So without realizing the value of having that multidisciplinary approach, somehow we were already doing that. And I think what school gave me was that ability to think, to focus on the human beings, to focus on their emotions or what drives them, on their rationality. And again, their emotions, and try to understand how to solve their needs, no matter what is the media, no matter what is the solution. And so it became somehow easy later on when I started to work in the industry to realize that the solution to a human being need for a company as big as 3M or PepsiCo couldn't be just a product. Couldn't be just a piece of packaging, couldn't be just branding. It needed to be holistic, you know, multidisciplinary by definition.
After you graduated, you freelanced for 2 years before joining Philips Design. And while you were in school, you'd met Stefano Morzano, who was head of design at Philips, and even at that point elected him as your mentor. You've said that he changed your life. How so?
Well, Stefano, first of all, I call him my virtual mentor because he was not aware to be my mentor. You know, he was my mentor.
Oh, and he was a magical thinking mentor.
but look, this I think is a very interesting idea today in the world we live in, because many times people tell me, well, I live in a little village in the, you know, in the middle of nowhere in India, or in Japan, or in Brazil, or even in the United States, and I don't have access to certain people. And well, I was living in a little village in Italy, you know, the little Varese. I was not living in Milan, I was living in Varese. And back then, what happened is that I was 18, and I remember I was on a bus going home, and a friend of mine, once again, these friends of mine, friends are precious, you know, a friend of mine calls me, and she's like, you know, there is Stefano Marzano here at our house. Stefano was living back then in Holland, where the headquarters of Philips was. And he was the friend of the father of this friend of mine. So she calls me because randomly, by coincidence, few weeks earlier, we talked about design. And she told me, oh, the friend of my father is Stefano Marzano, a famous designer. And I knew about him. And we started to talk. So long story short, she calls me. I am in this bus. And she's like, come and for a coffee after lunch. And there's so much going on that day. I needed to go to do my soccer practice, and I couldn't miss, you know, I was practicing soccer semi-professional. You couldn't miss one training. So many important things. But what did I do? I dropped everything and I went. Sliding doors, literally sliding doors. So I went, and I was really excited by, you know, I met him and I got really excited by, you know, his way of thinking, his passion, his vision, and many other things. So back then I was fresh of study of philosophy in high school. And I remember all these philosophers that would write to each other. Usually there was, you know, the older philosopher and the disciple, or the student, they would write. And much of what we learn, what we study today of philosophy, is that writing, that exchange between the student and the professor. So I was like, oh, I'm going to do the same with Stefano Marzano. So I wrote him a couple of letters. Obviously, Stefano, you know, very busy man. He never answered to me. But I wouldn't miss an occasion where he would come to Italy for a conference to be there and listen to him. But he did something a couple of years later that was really, really important. He took two books that he published with Philips, and he decided to send them to me. I still have them here today in this house. And he wrote me, the books were in English. I didn't speak a word of English because I had to study French. I studied French in Italy. They decide for you back then what you study. And 20% of Italians were forced to study French. So I didn't speak a word of English. And he wrote me something like, you really need to learn English if you ever want to do something, you know, in life. And so I give you this book in English instead of in Italian so that you can practice. Now, today it seems obvious. Back then, it was not that obvious. I could have had a brilliant career in Italy without speaking a word of English back then. So I received this. I'm like, wow, I really need to do it. And my parents, you know, we never traveled. We never left Italy once. So they wouldn't push me to study English. I needed somebody outside of the family circle to give me that push. So I decided to renounce to a scholarship that I want to go to Paris the year later. And then I waited, I apply again, and I won again a new scholarship, thank God, to go to Dublin. So at 24 years, when I was 24 years old, I learned English for the first time. And by the way, I didn't go to study English. I went to study design. So I had to do all the exams in a language that was not my language. So not easy. Wow. Getting completely out of my comfort zone. When I was there, I didn't have the money to be there, you know, to enjoy the place. And the school was paid. My parents were giving me the money for the apartment, but anything else, I didn't have a penny. I didn't speak the language, so I couldn't work as a waiter in a restaurant. So I found a job cleaning dishes in the cafeteria of the school. And I remember, you know, I'm writing a book right now, and that story is fresh to my mind because I just wrote about this. And I was there cleaning my dishes, and I was totally fine. I actually was very happy because they would pay me so much money, so much more than anything I could earn in Italy with other kind of jobs, even as a designer. So I was really, really happy. And I remember one day somebody coming there, some of the students of the school, and see me washing dishes there. And they started to laugh and they started to make fun of me. And that hurt me so much, so much. But what hurt me the most was the realization that I didn't see it coming. Because for me, it was perfectly fine to wash dishes, earn the money, to then enjoy, you know, that experience and everything.
Yeah.
And so after that, I realized something important, that often we live in life with so many blind spots. We don't see things that other people eventually can see. And that's why we need to be always, always completely open to listen to others, to understand the perspective of others, to absorb, you know, anything that is surrounding you. That's so, so important. And that's why, for instance, we talk a lot recently, or in general, about diversity. Diversity before anything else, before all the needs and responsibilities that we have, you know, to help communities that somehow have suffered, have been neglected in a variety of different ways. But even before that, diversity is so priceless and precious for anybody doing innovation or design, or anybody in life in general. Because simply, when you have somebody by you, they look at things with a different perspective, by definition, because that person has a different background, well, it will help you seeing all the different perspectives. And the more people diverse you have around you, the more diverse, you know, different perspectives you will gain. And by combining through dialogue and respect the different perspectives, you also have the possibility to build new perspectives that are unique and different, and they can really drive innovation in general, in the business world, in society, but also in your life. And also that can help you protecting yourself, defending yourself, like in that specific moment, you know, giving you awareness about things that you wouldn't see because you have your perspective and you need the perspective of others to broaden your perspective. Anyway, as usual, I've been diverging.
Yeah, it's wonderful.
But
it's wonderful.
Yes.
At that point in your life, you also met Claudio Cochetto. He's one of the most famous music producers in Europe. You've referred to him as the Jay-Z of Italy. And you've said that Claudio's vision was that every single aspect of a project that he worked on had to have infinite value. And this is a philosophy that stayed with you. How so?
Yeah, look, it's interesting because Claudio was a guy from the street. He was very visceral. You know, he was not very articulated in the way he was describing what he was doing. So, for instance, he never used once ever the word innovation, but he was one of the most innovative person I ever met in my life. Innovation was part of who he was. So anytime he would see something, would approach something, he had this need, visceral need, to do things, to do something that nobody ever did before. So from the little project all the way to changing the world, he was always, always driven by this need of creating something that nobody ever did before. And this is a mindset. It doesn't require more effort. It's just a way of thinking. So the way it really helped me, I always mention Claudio as my second biggest mentor, because together with Stefano are the two that really, you know, gave me something early on in my life. You know, he gave me that kind of mindset of, once again, any project that I receive, any brief, even my jobs, you know, when they gave me the job in PepsiCo in 3M, anything, I always try to understand how to do that thing, whatever it is, a job or a project, anything, in a different way, in a new way, in ways that nobody ever did before. And there is a technique to do that actually is a technique used by the philosophers for thousands of years. It's very simple. You always need to ask why. And when you have the first answer, you ask why again, and why again, and why again, and why again, until you arrive to the primary cause of why somebody's asking you something. You know, as an example, if they ask me to design a bridge, many designers will design an amazing bridge, a beautiful bridge, a very functional bridge. But if you ask why, Maybe you find out that you don't need a bridge. You know, you need to move people from A to B. Maybe you find out that you don't even need to move people from A to B. They can stay in A. They don't need to go. But if they do, maybe they don't need a bridge. Maybe a more efficient way is to invent the helicopter, imagining that it didn't exist before, or something that nobody ever thought of. You know, is Ford inventing the car where everybody, when everybody was used to the horses and were perfectly fine with the horses. So it's that idea of always, always trying to really deeply understand what people need. So for instance, when they gave me the job in 3M or in PepsiCo, I didn't listen to the brief. I didn't listen to the job description that they gave me. I tried to really understand what the company needed from design. And in both situations, I found out that they needed much more than what they were actually asking me. And so I've been working to build that awareness first and then to drive that kind of value over the years. The last thing, you know, that I want to mention that I think is very interesting, the why technique is the technique of the philosophers. But if you think, it's also what happened when you talk with a child. They always ask you why and why and why. How many people interacting with a child are like, you know what? I never thought about this. Let me check why, because I actually have no clue. So it's really human nature. The philosophers at the end of the day do that. They go back to really try to understand and find the primary causes of our own existence. And the kid in this journey of, you know, forming their identity, they are in that process. They are trying to understand who they are, why they exist, why the things surrounding them are in the way they are. And this is what we lose over the years. You know, over the years, we get so used to what surrounds us that we stop asking why. We stop even looking at things. We pass in front of something every day without even looking at what we have in front of us. You know, as a designer, for instance, thinking just about patterns, shapes, colors, nature is so full, so dense of beauty that is unbelievable that we never stop looking at. You know, I love, you know, a few years now, actually many years ago, I bought a macro lens for my camera. Or if you don't like cameras, you can use just the lens. So go out in your garden and start to look at the colors of the ants, for instance. We all think they're black. No, they're bluish, you know, metallic blue, or they have different colors, actually, reddish. Red. The spiders that we are so afraid of, the colors of the spiders, when you start to look at with a macro, even the one that look brown from far away, the colors are amazing, the patterns, the movement of a worm is so elegant. Would you ever say that a worm is elegant? But if you look at it, you know, it's so elegant the way they move. So again, inspiration can be found anywhere, but it's all about the way you look at things. And that idea of looking at the world with the eyes of a child, with a wonder, is really a magic formula. It really works. Always asking why.
Absolutely. I can't help but be reminded of something that Pablo Picasso said, that by the time he was 15, he knew how to paint like a master. But it took him his whole life to be able to paint like a child. We lose that innocence and that freedom. Linda Barry writes about that a lot as well, how to get back to that instinctual need and instinct to draw. You and Claudio found that.
Sorry, Debbie, I keep interrupting.
That's
you.
Okay. No, not at all. It's, you know, these remote interviews are a little bit challenging, and, you know, especially when two people like us want to just keep talking about things.
Well, quickly, you know, talking about another sliding door, I remember I was in high school the last year, and the director of the dean of the school, he gave the possibility to do some lessons in the afternoon, some lectures in the afternoon. They were totally optional. But, you know, I always had this thirst for knowledge, right? So I was like, oh, I want to go, you know, and I went. And I remember that's when I met that theory of the little child for the first time in an author that is an Italian author. His name is Pascoli. He's a poet from the beginning of last century. And he will talk about the fanciullino. That is a very, very old Italian word that nobody uses in Italian anymore to describe exactly that kind of attitude. And why I'm mentioning this, because once again, I did something that was out of my comfort zone. I really didn't want to go in the afternoon to do these things, but I was curious. I wanted to learn. I wanted to know things. And so I went and I learned something that stayed with me for the rest of my life, that really, you know, helped me. Now, another thing to remember is that, well, I learned that thing, but God knows how many hours I wasted doing these kind of things. So this idea of getting out of your comfort zone is not very efficient, you know, but that little thing that you learn from time to time is worth all the other efforts and make everything absolutely worthwhile.
So what was this thing that you realized? What did you learn?
Well, I mean, this idea of preserving that ability to look at the world like a child. You know, it was the first time that I met that theory in a formal way in this case, from a poet. Then it's not something, you know, many other people in the world over the centuries have been talking about this. But I did it there. I'm sure that I would have met, you know, that idea years later anyway. But it happened to me very early on. And I really cherished that from the very beginning. So, you know, that idea of that curiosity and asking why and everything. From the very beginning, I realized that it was very powerful, very important.
That is a gift. You and Claudio founded a design studio. You called it Wise Mad. But in 2002, you were recruited by 3M to join an Italian team piloted by the executive vice president of consumer business worldwide. You were just 27 years old. You commissioned Pininfarina, the design firm known for its work with Ferrari, to design a line of video projectors. And this resulted in a cutting edge space age binoculars. It doubled the product's annual sales. It earned 3M its first major design awards. How were you able, so soon in entering the organization, to be able to get 3M to take such big design risks at the time, right off the bat?
You know that nobody ever asked me something like this. It's the first time, and I did many interviews that actually gave me the possibility to tell a very interesting story.
Good.
What happened is that 3M invented the overhead projectors. So all the overhead projectors that many of us were using, you know, 3M invented that. And at a certain point, the world changed, and they needed to redesign completely the business. You started to use the multimedia projectors. And so they had a series of partnerships with a series of companies in Japan, but they were really struggling. It was really, you know, a difficult moment for that specific business. So what I'm trying to say is that I met the business in a moment of crisis. And that was point number one. Point number two, the leader of the business was somebody at the end of his career. And so he had nothing to lose. He just wanted to have fun and take risk. And so the combination of these two things were really magical, because the guy was like, you know what? The business is in crisis. I'm going to try. If I don't succeed, I'm going to retire anyway. Let's do it. And so I'm telling this, and we did it and we succeed. I'm telling this story because to do innovation is damn difficult. It's so, so difficult, especially in big corporations, because anything you do may have an impact of millions or hundreds of millions or sometimes billions of dollars on your company. And so it's not easy. And you need a series of factors, a series of things that happen to create the right conditions for innovation. So once again, a moment of crisis, of a moment of major change, is always a good moment to innovate. That's a message I've been sharing a lot in this period with COVID, for instance. You know, this moment is a unique opportunity to relook at everything we do, you know, as a society, as companies, as brands and businesses, and try to do things differently. It's really a unique opportunity. But in general, when you are in a crisis, imagine, you know, even as human beings, you have a job. If you are happy, probably you're not going to change that job. But if you are unhappy, you're in a crisis, you don't like the brand you work for, the company, your boss, or you're in a difficult situation, probably you're going to take the risk of changing, because, again, you want to better your situation. And if you don't, you may actually die or be in an even worse situation. So the crisis moment is actually an opportunity. The second thing is finding people that can be what I call the co-conspirators. So I've been always hunting, both in 3M, in PepsiCo, for people that could partner with us to change things, to drive a different kind of approach to anything we will do. And the co-conspirators have specific kind of characteristics. Among them is they need to be in the right position to take that kind of risk, to be able to take that risk, to have the credibility eventually to take that kind of risk. So when I joined PepsiCo, for instance, we map with HR, the co-conspirators inside the organization, and we started to work with them to build what I call the proof point. So to land something in market that somehow is generating value for the company. It doesn't need to be perfect. It needs to be good enough to generate some form of value for the organization. If you do, then other people, yes. And other people will be like, oh, we want to be part of it. And so you start to build more proof points, and then you start to grow in that way inside the organization, and then creating value for the business in general.
You talk about how methodologies like Six Sigma are all about reducing risk, but they're not really effective for innovation because innovation by definition is risky. But at the very base of innovation and entrepreneurship is risk. So how do you manage that dichotomy in a corporate environment where you always have to have a return on investment on any initiative that innovation to be able to do that is risky, but then Six Sigma is all about reducing risk?
Yeah, this is such an important question because immediately make you understand that if you are in charge of driving, designing innovation in a company, your job is not just the one of working on those projects that they give you or the projects you may identify. Your meta project, the biggest project, is to design the right conditions, processes, culture, and business model for this company to do innovation. So in this specific case, it's very important to let the company understand how to manage the portfolio in a way that gives you the possibility to take risk in certain areas of the portfolio, in some products, in some brands, and eventually reduce the risk in other areas. So first of all, is portfolio management. The second one is the way you test these ideas. So for instance, if you are a multinational corporation, you may decide to take some risk in what you do as a brand, but maybe you do it in a controlled environment. You could do it just with a customer. You could do it in a specific region of the world where the risk is not very high because the business is not that big. You could do it eventually in another form or shape. It could be a special edition of a packaging. It could be an event where in reality you're not changing the product or the brand, but you're experimenting. I've been using a lot of our platform of communications in this way. You know, I come, before joining PepsiCo, I was working in 3M, so a tech-driven company. The most of the investments were in technology and innovation. I go to PepsiCo, that is a brand-driven company, is a marketing-driven company, so huge investments in the brands. And so I will go to these events where these experiences that the company was building, where we were investing millions and millions of dollars to build these activations. And with my innovation background, I was like, oh my God, I mean, we're putting so much money in something that is just about communicating the brand. How can we leverage that money in a more efficient way to also try new things, experiment? And so I convinced the company early on to use events like Super Bowl or Milan Design Week or the UEFA Champions League final to try things, to try a new approach to experiences with the world of cola. And we invented the Cola House, to create different kind of experiences with sodas in general. And we build this experience that we call Bubbles that then we sold to Disney, we sold to Hershey Park, to Marriott, to a variety of different customers. So every time doing something with a clear ROI in communication, I mean, we're doing something that was a communication event, but in reality, most of the times we were experimenting. And it's a very interesting experiment because essentially give you the possibility to talk with consumers, with customers, with the media, with influencers, with many different people that will give you different kind of feedback. You collect different kind of data, and these are all insights to nurture your innovation pipeline. It's also interesting because they will build confidence, and this is a key word, confidence in the organization on trying things that eventually you didn't, you know, you were not really comfortable with. So how many times, I'm sure, you know, too many people this happened. You are in a company, you have great ideas, because usually ideas, you know, these companies don't have a lack of ideas. They have tons of ideas. The problem is to take that idea to market, because you have so many different roadblocks. It's difficult, it's risky. And so the company essentially lack inner confidence. The leaders of the company lack the confidence of taking that kind of risk. That's why, for instance, many of these companies invest millions and millions of dollars in consumer research and in a variety of different tools and methodologies to reduce the risk that they have. But the reality is that at the end of the day, because innovation is risky by definition, you need a form of personal confidence as a leader and therefore as an organization to take anyway that kind of risk. And so the ability that we have as designers to prototype, to create stuff, put it in the hand of people in a variety of different ways, behind the scenes, but also eventually through platforms of communication, in Super Bowl, in Milan Design Week. And you put in the hand of people, and people react in a positive way. They give you feedback. They interact with you. You tweak your ideas. You evolve your ideas. You progress your ideas. All of that, on top of everything, is also building confidence in the organization. When you see the customer excited about your idea, at a certain point, you're like, you know what? Maybe it's worth to try. Let's launch it. Let's do it. And it works. It works very well.
I define confidence in the corporate world as the successful repetition of any endeavor. So if someone knows that you have the ability to succeed at something in the way that you're doing it, they're more likely to let you do it again. In 2010, you moved from Italy to St. Paul, Minnesota to take over as the chief design officer of 3M. In 2012, you were recruited to PepsiCo as the company's first ever chief design officer. But almost any organization, Mauro, tends to reject a new culture. I know that when you were hired, the CEO, Indra Nooyi, was asking you, was expecting you to come in and change the culture at Pepsi, a company that is very large, very political, lots of different parts of the company that have different ways of running. What was the first thing you did at Pepsi to try to gain that credibility?
Was finding those co-conspirators with the being aware that I needed to find them in the countries, in the regions. I needed to find people that had control on brands and budgets and resources to make things happen. So for instance, something interesting, I started in the global organization, and right away I had three people under me. I mean, I had a team that was already there working on artwork production and execution of nine people. And then I hired three additional people to work more on strategy and really take, you know, design to the next level inside the organization. And of these three people, I decided to gift one of them to the United States beverage business. Now, this is a business with billions of dollars of budget and thousands of people under. And I had three people and I gave one to them. And I told them, look, this person is gonna just work on your projects. And this pissed off, by the way, a lot of people in other parts of the organization, but I knew that it was the right thing to do because I came from the same kind of journey in 3M, a journey where these companies that somehow are decentralized, try to go global, and then they go to the other extreme, and you need always to find the right balance. But long story short, I decided to, you know, to push the global strategy, but in alliance with a co-conspirator in the local organization. And with two of these people inside the US business, we brought to market very quickly two proof points. One was the redesign of Pepsi, and the other one was the design of this family of fountains that we call Spire, that are digital fountains where you can customize your drinks. They have been really powerful because essentially many people realize that very quickly, in a very efficient way, but with very high quality, we have been able to land solutions that were building value for the organization. And so once we did that, it was easier to drive the rest of the organization to invest in the same way. And the other thing that I did, I think, is very important for anybody that is starting a journey, you know, a similar journey in any other company. I decided to expose my CEO, Indra Nooyi, to other companies that were doing design in the right way. And obviously, I went to the companies that were really close to me, that I knew very well. So, and full credit to Indra Nooyi, she decided to do it because many other people eventually wouldn't do it. So we went to Seoul in Korea to meet the CEO of Samsung and spend an entire day focusing on how they were driving design in Samsung. We did the same with Philips. We did the same with 3M. So imagine I went to my own old company and I did something like this. And then we went to J&J. Back then, Chris Hacker was the head of design of J&J. And for me, J&J was very important because they had a design center in Manhattan. And I wanted to convince Indra to invest in building a design center in Manhattan. And Chris gave, you know, we did this meeting, and then at the end of the meeting, he gave me a meeting room. And so in the meeting room of J&J, in the design center of my CDO friend, I presented a plan to Indra Nooyi for investing in design and building a design center in Manhattan and hiring about 20 people to start in the city. And I love to mention this story also because it shows how important is the partnerships against all of us, all design leaders. We're not many, you know. Design is a nascent discipline in this new approach. It's been there forever, but in this new approach, it's kind of nascent, you know, these chief design officer positions in companies or a variety of different design agencies that are playing a very different role in collaboration with companies, big and small, the role of design in startup. So I think we really, really need to work together and be united to drive this new approach to innovation, to brand building inside these organizations. As a community, we need to be united. And sometimes we are not. We need to be united.
It's so important. You now run an organization with over 200 designers and strategists reporting through to you. You mentioned that you pissed some people off initially. How did you manage to hold on to your sense of what was right and necessary while knowing that people might be angry with you? I think that so many people in the design business are people pleasers. You had to move forward at a time where you knew very tangibly that people were pissed. How did you keep your center intact?
Look, so first of all, when a company try to build something new, many CEOs know that it's going to be really, really difficult. And so what they do often is they tell that person that they hire in any field. I saw this happening in new ventures, in marketing, finance. They tell these people, this person, look, I'm going to protect you. You are here to disrupt, to piss people off, you know, so they tell you that. And they saw so many times this kind of situations to miserably fail because, you know, yes, they protect you for a while, but you can't last in this way. When you create a new culture, you need to integrate the new culture within the culture of the company. Now, obviously, you need to drive change and you will piss off somebody, but you need to do it, I think, always showing that you are starting from a positive intent, that you are a loving person, that you are a good person, that you're not doing it for ego or for power, but you're doing it for the company. And you do that with a clear communication strategy. First of all, with sincerity and authenticity. You need to believe in it, because if you don't, sooner or later, people will feel it. But if you do, then in everything you do within the company, but also in the way you communicate outside of the company, across any kind of platform, people will feel it. They will start to see it. I really do not believe in burning bridges. I really do not believe in creating separations, walls. I hate it, even though, you know, I hate the word hate, but just to give you the idea, you know, I believe profoundly in creating bridges. And so one of the things I always tell myself and my teams is this: when you are in front of somebody, whoever it is, ask yourself this thing. how can I help that person to succeed? Especially the one, you know, the business leaders, for instance, how can I make that person successful? Both in the business world, so for instance, you know, you help them with the project that they have and everything, but try to understand what drives these people beyond the business world, what keep them up at night, you know, what are their personal goals, you know, and help them achieving them. If you do that, leveraging your assets, you make yourself indispensable. So even with the people that eventually were pissed, I always try to go back to them, give a hand, and try to work together. Because at the end of the day, the most of the time when people were pissed because they were losing control, resources, territories. So I try to go back to them and tell them, look, I need to do it. I'm going to do it no matter if you're with me or not. We need to do it. But look, if we do it together, it's a win-win situation. We can really win together. And so often many of these people came back. If they didn't, the most of the times is really literally because ego, losing control, losing power. So again, authenticity, positive intent, and trying to drive good things, I think is key. Even today, look, outside of the design world, we, you know, if you think about what's going on with the political situation in our country, or what's going on with racism in our country in a variety of different ways. If you look at all these things, you know, when I see from any side post of hate, of divisions, of separation, I lose my mind. Because we're all fighting for one thing, that is democracy, love, connections, and so we need to use those tools to drive that change. And so even when I'm now going back to my companies and what I'm trying to do, I want to build value for the company. So I can't divide the company. I can't fragment the company. I need everybody to drive against that objective. So it's a fine balance of pissing people off, but then giving them a hand and like, come on, I mean, we can do it together. It's a win-win situation.
I have so many more questions that I want to ask you, but we don't have an infinite amount of time. So the last thing I want to talk to you about is your new podcast, In Your Shoes. I understand you have 350 pairs of shoes. Is that true?
I lost the count, but yeah, I have a lot. I'm not proud of it, actually. It's pure consumerism, but, you know, my weakness.
Is the title of your podcast inspired by your passion for footwear?
It is a little bit, of course. But, you know, we were thinking about what could be the title. And what I wanted to do with this podcast, and you know it very well because you were one of my very good guests, was to enter in the mind of people. By the way, is the definition of empathy, if you think about it. And this, you know, empathy is what should drive any designer, any innovator, from Greek, empathos, you know, going into the soul of the other person, changing perspective, understanding their point of view. So in English, there is, as in Italian, there is this expression of being in their shoes, right? So it came out very natural. And then I was like, oh, wait a second. And then there is also this passion that I have. So it was just like perfect. It was really me, but it was really explaining what the intent was of this podcast as well.
Why did you decide to create a podcast right now? What was the motivation in creating this new endeavor for yourself?
Well, the idea, first of all, personally, I have always this need of sharing and talking and communicating. And I think by inviting the right people, you can do it through them. So those people usually are amplifiers of ideas that I really want the world to hear about. And so in the specific case of PepsiCo, then, that is anyway the company that is sponsoring the podcast, is not my podcast, it's the podcast of the company. The idea was to build awareness within our organization about design and what design can do. So I'm using every platform that I have, every tool that I have to amplify that kind of awareness. The second thing that I really, really liked was the idea that the corporation could this to, could take a point of view, could take a stand, and could become part of the conversation on design. It's not that obvious, you know. There is your beautiful podcast. I think there are a couple of great podcasts, you know, out there, and but they are driven by individuals like you. The idea that a company can take a position and create a design podcast, I think, I hope, is going to be an inspiration for many other companies to embrace design, to do things in a different way. I'm not going to mention the company, but one time I went again with Indra to this other company to meet the CEO of this other company and the head of design of this other company. And then the head of design came to me after and he was like, this was great. It was great because it shows my own CEO how committed PepsiCo is. And so it's an inspiration for my own company as well. So I think the more companies are loud and vocal about the value of design, the more many other companies will play, will be inspired by that. And we can together, once again, try to push the creation of a design culture in so many different kind of realities.
Mauro, my last question is this. You've said that one of your hopes in creating your podcast is that it could help other designers build a creative culture in their own organizations. And for anyone that's looking to build a new creative culture in their organization, particularly as we recover from COVID, what would you recommend that we do?
First of all, looking at the crisis as an opportunity in a very positive way, understanding what this crisis is doing to society, focusing on what were the trends before COVID, and now this crisis is somehow accelerating some of these trends. So for instance, the focus on people, on human needs. There is this huge investment in new technologies to collect data, to be closer to what you know people need and want, especially because the society was reacting so fast and changing so fast, you know, in what they wanted, in their emotional reaction, that all these companies needed to understand in real time what was going on. And so, you know, how technology can help us being more consumer-centric, more people-centric, more human-centered. This is a unique opportunity, for instance. The world of sustainability is another world that is being accelerated by this crisis. Health and wellness. I'm just mentioning few that are very relevant for our company, but there are others out there. So if you are building right now a new culture inside your organization, try to understand how society is changing and how design or creativity can be leveraged to help your company facing this new challenge. And also, many companies are looking at this situation of crisis in a negative way. As a designer, you try to switch it, to change it in a positive perspective. Try to show the company how you can really leverage this difficult moment to build something better and different in the future. There is something very amazing, I would say, I would use this word, that PepsiCo did in the past few months. It was very inspiring even for me. At the very beginning, when the COVID crisis started, right away, they built three teams from the very top of the company and then across the hierarchy of the organization. The first one was all about reacting as fast as possible with agility and efficiency to the moment of crisis. The second one, at the very beginning, was already rethinking about what is going to happen when we get out of the crisis. And so it was out of the crisis to 6 months, but we had no clue when we were going to get out of the crisis. We are still today in the middle of it. So, but already in March, we had a team working on this scenario planning and everything. And then what I think is amazing was a third team from the very beginning, looking at what we're going to do in the next 3 years. And essentially, what was the reason of this? Was the idea was, let's look at everything this crisis is forcing us to do and with a positive spin. So, okay, if we need to do investments, for instance, in technology right now, because we need technology to help us working from home, can we do investments that are going to really be important for the future of the company? And if we do, maybe we double down on those investments. We do even more than what we did now, because anyway, we're going to build the future of the organization. So always this ability to not be stuck in the present, but looking at things in perspective, getting out of the overwhelming present and understanding in perspective how you can leverage the present to become your better self as a company, but also as a human being. This applies also to our life. In a moment of crisis, there is a historian, his name is Tucidide, and he used to say, we need to study the past to understand the present and forecast the future. I think it's so, so powerful, you know, understanding where we come from, understanding where we are and why we're here by understanding where we come from, and understanding that is literally putting things in perspective. You see the path, you see the journey, and you know where to go and how to push to arrive to where you wanna get.
Mauro, thank you for that wonderful advice. I think it's really important these days to take this opportunity to really try to not only understand our motivations and who we are in the world, but also how we want to show up in the future that we make together. Mauro, I want to thank you so much for... Oh, I'm sorry. Please go ahead. I don't want to interrupt you ever.
As usual. you mentioned the situation where we are here today. I think because we are so focused on the present, often we forget the present is designed in this way for mistakes we made in the past. Correct. Understanding the past will help you understanding things that are not right today so that we can design a better future for tomorrow. For us and the generations to come, is our responsibility of all of us to do it. So let's start from the past, yes. Change the present, yeah. To shape a better future.
And if not now, when? Mauro Porcini, thank you so much for bringing so much design exuberance to the world, and thank you for joining me today on this very special episode of Design Matters Live at the Promax Conference. To see
thank
more of Mauro's work, oh, my pleasure. To see more of Mauro's work, you can go to pepsi.com. You can follow him on LinkedIn, where he has a wonderful following. And you can also listen to his superb podcast, In Your Shoes, wherever podcasts are found. This is the 16th year we've been podcasting Design Matters, and I'd like to thank you for listening. And remember, we can talk about making a difference, we can make a difference, and we can do both. I'm Debbie Millman, and I look forward to talking with you again soon.
Design Matters is produced by Curtis Fox Productions. The show is recorded in non-pandemic times at the School of Visual Arts Masters in Branding program in New York City, the first and longest-running branding program in the world. The editor-in-chief of Design Matters Media is Zachary Pettit, and the art director is Emily Weiland.